Yo, how we doing?
Hey guys.
Did you get the retweet out? We already had some technical difficulties, as is the theme. I couldn't start the spaces and then it crashed and I don't know what's happening. So I don't know if everyone's going to be here today, all the listeners we had scheduled. I'm sure they're sitting there at home wondering what happened. But we have episode 27 of Wrecked Radio with Pac-Man, one of the core contributors of Blur. Yeah, what's up? Do you want to talk about our sponsor real quick before we get into what's going on today?
Yeah, as KBM mentioned, the original space rug. So if you guys are listening to this, please feel free to retweet and post the space so we can get everyone on here. But yeah, as you guys know, this show is sponsored by Rollbit, one of the largest crypto casinos out there. And you can do anything from sports betting, futures trading, NFT borrowing lending, and NFT trading on that platform. Rollbit.com or Rollbot.com is the URL depending on the jurisdiction. And as usual, we'll have two codes to give out during the show, and we'll have a loot box spin at the end. First code is Pac-Man Wow 99. Pac-Man Wow 99. And if you guys want to watch this show on YouTube, there's a live video stream. Just check the pinned tweet on the space for the link, and we'll put the codes up there as well. I'll pass it back over to KBM.
Yep, Rogue Radio YouTube. We're live there as well. So what's up, guys? How are we?
Good, man. Good. Nothing's really happened over the last week, right? What about you?
No. I mean, a little up and then a little down. I mean, yeah, I don't know. Some squeezes. I'm short again, as is tradition.
As is always.
Yeah, I mean, until it goes to where I want. And I think I'm right, but we'll
Didn't
see
it
what
hit where
happens.
you wanted, though? This is what I didn't understand. Like, it got to that level, right? Very
No,
briefly.
I'm looking for it to get to like 24,000.
Right. Okay.
And then zero. No, I'm kidding. And then lower, probably, but that'll depend on market conditions. I mean, we got some economic data, as always, coming up. They do that at, monthly. So here we are again. What have you guys been doing?
Don't know.
Not
Like, I've still
much,
been doing the same stuff. Like, just to be honest, I've been buying dips in ETH, Bitcoin, still selling alts. It's been a good trade this year, just like shorting alts versus Bitcoin ETH. Bitcoin dominance keeps going up. Been pretty chilled. And then there's a big conference in Lisbon next week. Are you coming?
I'm not gonna make it. What is it? NFT Lisbon, I think you said.
NFT Lisbon. I'm sure
Is that
everyone
what
will
it
be.
is? They just picking cities and doing NFT in front of it. What are you guys doing there?
Well, I live there, so
Yeah, that's true.
yeah, that's just a few like planning for that coming up. But yeah, been cool. Farouk's actually in London with
London right now,
OSF.
yeah.
What have you been doing, OSF?
Not much. I haven't really been trading that much. To be honest with you, like after the shitcoin season, kind of just been writing everything to zero, and that I have in shitcoins. And
You bought an autoglyph.
I did buy an autoglyph. I did buy an autoglyph.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did spend a bit of the ETH, but to be honest with you, I'm happy just chilling in mostly ETH. I think we could go a little bit lower, and then I think we'll go higher again. But just kind of like not try and trade it. Just getting warm here in London, playing a bit of golf. Taking some time away from the screens,
Yeah.
not trying to
I mean,
overthink
touching
it.
grass, right?
Wrecked Radio meetup. I thought you might come to London at one stage. There was rumors last December that you
Me?
were. Yeah.
Yeah, no. Are you gonna come if I go to London?
Oh, for sure. For
Yeah, I
sure.
don't know. I mean, we gotta plan it. I have some trips on the books, but not to London, unfortunately. I'm doing Indonesia for scuba diving, so that should be a
Oh, that's very
adventure.
different. Yeah.
Yeah, so that'll be
Bali
fun.
or somewhere else?
No, it's like Bima Island and then Lombok. I mean, we're staying on a yacht. I'm actually going with Fon Ro. People know him from the
Oh,
NFT space.
yeah.
He booked it randomly. Was like, yeah, we're going scuba diving. Crazy trip in Indonesia. First of all, I didn't know how hard it was to get to a random island in Indonesia. It takes like 35 hours from where I am. So that
Lombok's
kind of
not
horrible.
tough, but the other one I've never heard of.
Yeah. I mean, we're gonna be on the boat the whole time. And then you dive with like whale sharks, hammerhead sharks, you hike with Komodo dragons. It's a real adventure, once in a lifetime trip. So I'm looking forward to that. But other than that, I'm just gonna play the World Series of Poker this summer in Vegas. But
You see the
no
hand?
London yet. I did see the hand last night that Tom played. I mean, it was sick. I don't know. It was a crazy, pretty sick bluff by
Kind of a
Wesley.
weird hand, right? Because Doug, it's seen
Yeah, I don't know if that affected too
table.
much. I mean,
I know, no. I don't think it affected it, but it just seemed weird that there were like three people in the hand.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It was a lot of money on the line for sure. I mean, Tom made the correct call, but pretty hard fold. I don't know. You're just either, yeah. I don't know. It was a good play.
Should get him on the show,
Tom. Yeah. No, I can. We can ask him. Perfect. But all these guys are out for the summer. All the poker guys. So we're not gonna have any poker guys for the whole summer. We got a lineup of them because they're all playing World Series right now. But they're all coming on the show, and after the summer, they all said yes. So definitely, awesome. We'll have them on. We'll have to hear about these tales of high varying swings. But yeah, let's bring on Pac-Man Blur before we get too sidetracked. One of the core contributors of Blur. How you doing, man? You're muted right now. Oh, never mind. You're unmuted.
GM.
How we doing? We got the nice Blur avatar right here. That thing's pretty badass. So we might need to get those made for us and do like a avatar anime type episode or something.
That'd be good. I always enjoy being able to use this avatar. Haven't really used, you know, taken it out of the garage in a while, but you know, glad I got to put it on today.
Yeah, wait, I have an NATO one. If I knew you were using that, I would have put it on. But anyway, how you been doing, man? What's new with you? Anything going on lately?
Yeah, actually, today is a pretty exciting day. It's day 500 for us working on Blur. So it's been exactly 500 days of Blur.
Wow.
That's badass.
What did you guys do to celebrate?
Honestly, we're so bad at celebrating. you asking me that reminded me that we should do something to celebrate.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an accomplishment. I mean, you guys have taken over a ton of volume from OpenSea and become one of the premier markets, definitely the traders market. I mean, I love the market as an investor, not just biased. But it's been great, the work you guys have done to bring liquidity to NFTs and kind of change the landscape a little bit from what it was.
Yeah, it's been a pretty wild ride. You know, and on the point of celebration, it's like, you know, I think we always... just given the gaps in the market, we expected that Blur would do well, but you know, becoming a leading marketplace by volume within like the first 2-3 months and then sustaining that continually, it's really been incredible. It's funny because with other contributors, I'll often be like, oh, like when we hit this milestone or hit this milestone, like we got to go and do something. But I think it's been such a busy time period that every time we hit the milestone, it's like we almost don't even notice just because it's just so hectic all the time. It's really been 500 nonstop days. But yeah, it's been great to be here.
Yeah, man, heads down grinding. So let's start a little bit about your background and like how you got involved with Blur, where you were before Blur, and yeah, just your journey so far to where you've gotten. I mean, like, Nate, were you a founder previously, or like, have you founded any corporations or companies? I don't know.
Yeah, totally. So my background's originally in engineering. I got my start in Silicon Valley around 9 years ago. Started off at a company called Teespring and worked as a software engineer there and did that for about a year. And then I started my first business back in 2016 and went through Y Combinator in their winter 16 batch. And I had a bit of a atypical path actually. So I dropped out of high school to do YC. I was 17 at the time, you know, finished up my sophomore year and then never went back, started working out in Silicon Valley, you know, after doing YC. And then basically I did that for a year at my own company and decided that I really wanted to go to college. After doing YC, I ended up studying at MIT. So I went back to school, studied math and computer science there. And then I dropped out again, actually. So I met Galaga, who's, you know, the other core contributor, like OG core contributor of Blur. We started working together and started working on side projects. And he actually ended up graduating a year early. I received the Teal Fellowship to drop out. So it's the same fellowship that like Vitalik got. And I think one of the founders of Polkadot got, and the Figma founder also got it. So I was super lucky to receive the Teal Fellowship and actually dropped out at MIT to start our first business together, which was Namebase. That was like a blockchain domain registrar that we ran for 3 years. And then we sold it at the end of 2021 to Namecheap, and then started working on Blur afterwards. But, that's kind of like a quick 30-second summary of my, you know, entire professional history.
It's pretty amazing because I think, I guess you guys are pretty young and maybe, people don't realize like how much experience that you've had in like founding something and actually successfully competing it, selling it, and moving it onto this one. Was NFTs and I guess NFTs in particular, was that something that you guys were into before you started Blur? You probably had some knowledge of it, but have you guys been like active traders and participants in the space, or like how did you guys like stumble across it?
Yeah, totally. So NFTs was really interesting because, you know, just to give some context on the previous business that, we exited, the business was called Namebase, and it was a blockchain domain registrar. Basically, there was this really niche blockchain called Handshake that would allow you to register these decentralized domain names. And we effectively kind of built like the GoDaddy of that blockchain. But as part of the function of building that registrar, we also needed to build a lot of financial infrastructure to support just even like registering the domain names. So the way that you register these names was by utilizing the Handshake token. Because the token was such a niche blockchain, we had to build our own services. So we had to build our own spot exchange. We had to build our own fiat on-ramp. There weren't any like node providers. Like there was no like Infura or Alchemy for Handshake. So we actually ran our own nodes. We had to customize the nodes. We had to custody everything ourselves and cold storage and hot wallets and everything like that. And we manage, you know, like tens of millions in assets as like this like custodial exchange. So it was this really interesting experience because we basically just got a ton of experience building up this financial infrastructure. We had to, you know, onboard our own market makers into the spot exchange and, you know, deal with all that. And so while Namebase as a business, you know, the rest of the DeFi ecosystem like really popped off, you know, starting in 2020, which was like when we launched. And, you know, while we grew like 10x, it was like the rest of the market was growing like 100x. So it was really interesting because we didn't get to really participate in that, you know, crazy turbulent growth. But the experience of building Namebase was really critical to giving us the experience needed to build Blur. And, you know, how we got into Blur was, you know, in 2021, as I was selling Namebase, I personally got really into NFTs. One of my acquaintances from the real world, Warm Emoji, if you're familiar with him, he actually did YC with me like back in the day. And basically it was like in one of our group chats that he like texted and was like, oh, like I worked on this project, it's called Blipmaps, you guys should check it out. And I was like, oh, like what is this NFT thing? So I ended up going on and I minted a Blipmap, and I just like held it the entire time. And then I ended up selling it like near the all-time high for like 25 ETH. And then afterwards, I was just like super hooked. I was like, what is this crazy ecosystem? And actually, it made a lot of sense to me. It wasn't like hard to understand NFTs because Namebase, which was our previous business, it was basically this product. It was like this marketplace for these like blockchain domain names, right? So like domain names are basically like a specific kind of NFT. So we were already used to working with these like decentralized non-custodial assets. And then when I found NFTs, I was like, oh, this is like the same thing as what we've been working on in many ways, but just like way bigger, so much more energy in the space. And as I started getting really into NFTs, basically I found that all the existing marketplaces were just like really slow and clunky. I found myself, as I was trying to trade them, just really fighting with the infrastructure. And I wanted something that was really much like a, you know, Binance for NFTs effectively. And it didn't really exist at the time. So that's basically how we kind of came across NFTs and decided to start working on Blur.
Yeah, it's crazy to go back to like all the experience you've had with the things you've created already. It's like you're pretty seasoned vet going into Blur somehow at a young age. I mean, like it's kind of like you've had the crazy Silicon Valley experience with doing Y Combinator and all that stuff. I think like as me and as a listeners hear all this, it's like, what is the Silicon Valley experience like? What do you do in your spare time, and like what has it been like having so much success with all this stuff so early and so fast?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I kind of came of age in Silicon Valley. So I was I was 16 when I moved out there. I was like, I lived and breathed, you know, like the Silicon Valley culture. Like all of my friends and acquaintances were in startups. Like my good friends were like Jack Allman and Eric Kaza, who started this business called Lattice, which is like a multi-billion-dollar like HR startup, but it's like enterprise SaaS. So I was like very familiar with that. And then also, through Jack and through YC, I knew Sam, who ended up founding OpenAI, and got to meet all those guys. And it was like very, very steeped in that culture and wasn't at all into crypto at all, because all of my friends are working on SaaS startups, right, or other consumer apps and that kind of thing. But while I didn't really have the crypto experience, prior to 2018, just being in that environment gave me a lot of operating experience. I think the really crazy thing about Silicon Valley is that it's just whether you want to or not, you're just going to learn the best practices in terms of what those peak execution look like. I really think that, Silicon Valley, it's probably Silicon Valley and Shenzhen in China, right? That's probably where you find the hubs of the best operators, the best startup operators and executors in the world. So being there, you really just learn a lot in terms of, how to build. So it was really fortuitous that I got to spend, my teenage years there.
But I mean, is it like the show Silicon Valley? Have you seen that show? Or is that just a parody of it?
So at the time I was living in this Teal Fellow house, and it was so funny because that house was where all the Teal Fellows would live, and they all had stories of Vitalik crashing on the couch there and being oh, hey guys, I can't really pay you, but I can give you some ether as payment for crashing on this couch. And everyone was no, it's good. You can keep your ether. And then that was super, super early on. And then it would have been worth hundreds of thousands or more at this point. So it's kind of funny, but I was very deep in the culture there. And Silicon Valley as a show was honestly boring for me because I was oh, this is literally just this is just real life. The things that the show parodied, they weren't really even parodying. It was just taking real life things and writing it into a show. So it was in a way it was somewhat entertaining, but also not entertaining, because I was oh, this is just real life. Why am I watching a show that completely accurately depicts real life? They didn't really even exaggerate things. It's pretty shocking how entertaining the show was without really exaggerating what actually goes on there. So yeah, I've watched it, but it never really got super into it.
Yeah, you're I live this life. Go ahead, Mando.
Could you give us the short version of what you learned during that period? Not many people get to spend time in the Peter Thiel house. You obviously were around these sort of people, and you said you live and breathe it. What are your main takeaways from an upbringing like that, or at least a coming of age period like that?
Yeah, I think the big thing is, actually, if you follow a few of Nikhil's, Nikhil from Alchemy, he has a few interviews where, because I'm pretty sure he previously worked at Facebook pretty early on, and if I recall correctly, he was describing sitting a desk away from Mark Zuckerberg and being Zuckerberg is smart, but he's not that much smarter than me. I should be able to do this too. And I think that's the key thing that you kind of learn just being in that environment, because I think something that really holds people back usually is this kind of it's kind of unbelievable to kind of think that you can go and start a business, whether it's a protocol or a company, and have it be worth, $10 million, $100 million, $1 billion, or even more. It's kind of this thing that's just not normal at all. And it's you kind of have to be crazy to believe in it. But I think the cool thing about Silicon Valley is when you spend time there, you realize oh, the people achieving these things, they're very competent people and they're hardworking, but they're not that much different than me. And it really kind of gives you this sense of oh, this is actually possible. I don't know what it is exactly that is going to be the thing, but I know that in terms of having what it takes, it kind of normalizes that. So that I think is really the biggest lesson, because, the majority of people, there's so many competent people out there that are just working, at Google or some FANG, and, they won't start a company because they feel it's very risky. And impossible. But then when you spend time in Silicon Valley, you kind of realize oh, the people making it are actually pretty normal, or just they're competent, right? High executive function, but they're relatively normal people.
Yeah, I get that. Go ahead, Mano.
I was just going to say, do you think that now with all these AI tools in some ways I was thinking about how the startup life is going to be right now, because it feels like the barriers to entry for a lot of industries are going to be reduced massively. And in some ways, the idea to replicate an idea becomes easier and easier. Do you think that's going to shift at all, how people think about startup concepts over the medium term, let's say?
Yeah, it's, I mean, the short answer is yes, definitely. This is such a game-changing shift. It's the Industrial Revolution. It's hard to understate how massive this is. It's really even unclear to me, how does society reshape around AI. But it's also kind of a question of how good does AI get? It's really hard to predict these things. Like, I remember one of my friends or acquaintances was like at AI, OpenAI really early on, like one of the researchers there. And I remember this was like 5 years ago. And I was like, oh, like, when do you think we'll get like AGI? And he was like, oh, I think we're like 6 months away. And then, you know, now we're like, now it feels like much more believable, but it's just like 5 years later. With these kinds of things, it's just like stupid hard to predict how good can it get, how quickly. Like, are we actually on the cusp of AGI, or is it like there's going to be some sort of ceiling that we hit and it requires like a completely new architecture and it's going to be like another 50 years until we figure anything out? Like, you know, I think it's pretty hard to predict that. So, you know, barring any sort of like crazy step function advancements in AI, is like in terms of like looking at the existing tooling and what's possible. And also, like, I'm not an expert on AI at all. So this is just going to be like me with my fairly relatively ignorant takes on everything without deep knowledge. But I think with the existing tooling, at least what I would expect is the barriers to entry on the lower end of like opportunities is definitely lower. Like, I know there are people who are like, you know, kind of like business oriented people that don't know how to code, that are just like scraping together little apps with their, you know, maybe like little like SaaS apps with like OpenAI, and they're, you know, like launching these businesses, and they're actually like making like, you know, a few hundred K in ARR. Like, it's kind of like a ridiculous thing to think that they could like go and do that, but like that's possible now with AI, right? Or there's even that like one creator the other day that, you know, like they like launched that token, like Turbo or whatever, you know, using AI to launch that. So I think those are just examples of the barrier to entry on like the lower end of, in terms of like the lift of opportunities is definitely like low, you know, reduced. But in terms of what does it take to build like really massive infrastructure or technical projects, I don't think that the barrier to entry to that has really changed. I think the only thing that's changed is that the practitioners of that are able to do more now with AI than they were before, because like there's just like a lot of monotonous work out there that, you know, like even like the smartest people have to cycles doing like plumbing and random things like that. And if you can like take those people and let them avoid the plumbing and just have like the AI do it for them, that just frees them up to spend time on like the hard things. But the hard things are still hard, so it doesn't really like make it any easier, if that makes sense.
Yeah, have you guys found any ways to integrate AI into Blur, any use cases like that?
Yeah, I think in terms of like exchange infrastructure, you know, nothing immediately, like there's of course like, you never say never, and I would say it's probably not something that we've thought deeply enough about. But in terms of like using AI in our day-to-day, like everyone's using like ChatGPT. I honestly don't know anyone in my life that's like not using ChatGPT, like whether they're technical or not technical. Pretty sure like everyone's using it at this point, like even as just like a replacement to Google. So I think like that's where you really see the usage. I do think there's going to be like massive, you know, AI powered products coming out into the world, you know, in the next like 12, 24 months. But it's unclear to me if how relevant it'll be to the NFT space at least.
Yeah, it's funny that you say everyone in your life's using ChatGPT. I mean, like, I don't think that's like a standard experience. I feel like a lot of normal people have no idea how to use it, don't know what to expect from it. I feel like, you know, I mean, like, I probably don't use it enough. So you're saying, like, if you're not using ChatGPT, you're definitely, like, missing out or falling behind here. And, you know, you should be using your everyday life, basically, as a replacement for Google, almost.
I think the interesting thing about, you know, you were talking about, like, Silicon Valley and what the benefits. I think the other benefit of Silicon Valley is you really do live in the future. You know that saying, it's like, the future is already here. It's just, like, not evenly distributed. That's very much true. And what you see typically in Silicon Valley is the new trends and technologies, they get adopted like years or even like decades, like up to a decade before like the rest of the world adopts it. So like, yeah, like everyone's using ChatGPT in Silicon Valley. That's like definitely very much like a norm. If you look at like other trends, right, like people were really into crypto and going to Bitcoin conferences super early on in San Francisco, like, you know, half a decade before it got really popular. You know, you had local, like everyone in Silicon Valley always talks about psychedelics all the time. And then now we're seeing psychedelics becoming more and more normalized. Everyone's doing like ayahuasca trips and everything like that. So, it's really interesting across like many different spectrums, like not just technology, right? Because it's like taking psychedelics isn't really a technology thing. But a lot of trends seem to kind of get picked up first in Silicon Valley for whatever reason. I would imagine it's similar to like if you live in like New York or LA, like you're probably living in the future in terms of like what the next big cultural movement is going to be before it really spreads to the rest of the world. I think it's kind of like a similar thing in Silicon Valley, but just, you know, oriented towards technology.
I've got a question to go back to, go back to stuff in terms of like building things and creating things in the space. Like what, in your experience and at Namebase and Nabla, like what skills do you perceive a builder needs to be successful in the space? I know some of them will be like, you know, having a good knowledge of like coding and all that kind of stuff, but in terms of like the psychological and the mental aspects, like what things do you think have helped you be successful, and like what things do you think are things that you guys have found challenging, and what are like, you know, the good like mental skills someone needs to be a successful builder in the space?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's different for every opportunity. Like certain kinds of building a protocol is kind of like a different skill than building like a normal web app or an iOS app or, you know, a D2C company, et cetera, et cetera. So there are a lot of different aspects of the skill, but I think when you're building software products, there's just like a lot of like basics that are shared in terms of, you know, I think a lot of times when you first start building and you first, you know, if you like start your first company, it's very easy to get distracted by like every stray idea that comes around. And you know, there are a lot of stories of like first time founders where it's like after their startup fails or maybe their startup doesn't fail, you know, they're one of the lucky ones and they succeed in spite of their, limited capacity for execution. But you know, you'll see their stories and they'll be like, oh yeah, like I was changing roadmap priorities like every single week. You know, like every new idea I would have, I would just like be like, drop everything. Let's go after this. And then it's just like very easy to kind of like get into these like bad habits, and, you know, fall for these like traps, I would say. Whereas after building for a while, you kind of get a stronger sense of like what's important and what's not. And that sort of like prioritization is very, very helpful. And then of course, also just in terms of the raw skill set of like what you're building, right? So it's like at Namebase, we built a marketplace for the names. We built a spot exchange. A lot of those experiences are super helpful, across, pretty much like anything that we want to build, but definitely especially for like an NFT marketplace, like a lot of those skill sets definitely translate. I think in terms of like some other things that are really helpful is, you know, especially at Namebase, like we were a custodial exchange. So security was very important to us. So we had to develop really strong security practices. You know, we were never hacked. We had really strong OPSEC, and you can never get like perfect at OPSEC. You can always try to do as well as you can, because you're like always vulnerable in some way. And just kind of like understanding that and learning that versus a lot of times I think you see builders in this space, especially they come into this space and they don't necessarily have this background of strong security practices with like high consequences for, you know, not building things the right way or not having good OPSEC. And then, you know, you see like some hacks occur or you see like they wrote the code the wrong way. And that can happen to anyone. But of course, I think just like having the experience definitely helps to, reduce the likelihood of those issues. So, there's like a lot of things involved to it. It's interesting because in any new nascent space, there's always the opportunity for inexperienced builders to succeed, right? Because like no one really knows what they're doing. It's like, okay, even if you don't really know what you're doing, just because you're here doing something, that means you're like, you have a chance of succeeding. Whereas like in a more mature space, it's like, okay, if you don't know what you're doing, building like a fintech bank, it's like your thing's gonna fail. You have strong competition. There's like a lot of execution difficulties in doing that. You're probably not gonna make it. Whereas like in this space, it's like, oh, you can actually succeed even if you have like pretty much no experience. But at the same time, I think that's why you see so much volatility where it's like people put out apps and stuff and maybe there's issues and, you know, like the protocol gets rugged, like for, you know, whatever happens. And I think it's just like a consequence of it's a new space. People who succeed aren't necessarily going to be the most experienced operators. But it's just like, it kind of comes with the territory of being a new space.
I think one of the things about this space, Web3 and maybe crypto to an extent, is this idea of building in public. So like you roll something out and then, you know, thousands of people will have an opinion on it and everyone will comment on it and maybe they'll love it, maybe they'll hate it, maybe we'll get some criticism. How do you guys deal with that? Like, how do you guys find building in public and maybe what you did before wasn't as public? And how do you react to the criticism? Like, does it affect what you guys set out to build and want to achieve? And, you know, at times it must be a difficult thing to go through. Like, how does that affect you guys and how do you get around like the mental hurdle of like trying to please people versus, you know, going out there to build what you actually, you know, envisage?
Yeah, I think, you know, whenever you create anything, whether it's in Web3 or in Web2, you know, you're kind of signing up for dealing with criticism, right? You're signing up for when your thing hits a lot of praise, but then, you know, even like random bugs, just like various little things. Like if you have enough users, you're going to get someone that like, let's say like a specific button's like not working or something like that. Like you'll get people just like DMing you being like super angry and upset about that. And, you know, you'll get that criticism. And I think ultimately as a builder, you know, if you're going and doing that, you're basically signing up for that. It kind of comes with the territory. And I think it's like kind of like on the onus of the builder to be able to like manage the emotions around that. And when they get that feedback, to not just like dismiss it and be like, oh, like how could someone get so mad about like a button being off? And instead being like, okay, like what are they actually, like what's the actual issue here? It's like, oh, okay, they're really angry. Like maybe it's aggressive, but they're angry because like this button is not working as it should be. That's helpful feedback. I can go and take that and, you know, make an improvement, you know, from that feedback. So I think ultimately, you know, like the criticism and the praise, like it all just kind of comes with the territory and just like the cost of doing business. And ultimately what's important is, can you like take the feedback, and ultimately like, you know, make the experience better for people. That's really the only thing that matters at the end of the day. And that's what's important to focus on.
Yeah.
I was about to say, can we get into the nitty-gritty of the actual problem that was presented with you about, I guess, 9 months ago or 500 days ago? You said you saw the NFT space, you saw OpenSea, well, you saw maybe current competitors at the time were a little bit weak. How did you think about the space? How did you think about how to basically attack the space? Where would you be strong? Like, how did you look at that problem and think, how can we solve it?
Yeah, I think, you know, ultimately it stemmed from my own needs. So having been active in NFTs myself, I got to experience, it was like the bull market. Everything was crashing all the time. You had to like refresh 1,000 times just to get like updated pricing and stuff like that. And, you know, you had to like spend your time across like 5 different pages just to kind of get all the information you wanted. So first it was just like, I had my own frustration with the infrastructure. And then I think from there, it was pretty clear to see the opportunity, because if you look at how the token market progressed, and actually pretty much every market in history, and especially financialized markets, they pretty much all progress in the same way. They get more professionalized over time. What you see is, you know, in the traditional market, like TradFi, it's like, there's like, you know, a handful of market makers, like even less, that drive the vast majority of the volume. I don't know the specific numbers off my head, but like I'm pretty sure Citadel is just like, it's like a gargantuan amount of, you know, all of the volume that you see in the market is like Citadel's on the other side of that. If you look at the token market, we started with infrastructure that was like very basic, right? You had like, you know, Mt. Gox, and you had Coinbase, really consumer friendly way to buy and sell Bitcoin. And then over time, you got these more and more advanced exchanges coming out. You know, Binance, OKX, Huobi, Deribit, you know, BitMEX, creating more and more advanced products. And then what you've seen is now there's a shift towards this professionalization, and it's like Wintermute and these other market makers now drive the vast majority of the volume in the token world. Similar thing with DEXs. You know, most people don't know this, but it's like, if you just look at where the volume comes from, the vast majority of the volume comes from like Wintermute and a few other market makers. Like I'm pretty sure like 30% of Uniswap's volume is just like Wintermute on the other side of that. So you see this in sexes, you see this in dexes, this sort of professionalization, it's a function of how markets mature. When we looked at the NFT space, and I kind of had this perspective just because we built a spot exchange at Namebase. So I kind of was, familiar, with some of these lessons. But, I knew as an NFT trader myself that the experience was like very suboptimal. And then I also knew from, studying the history of markets, it was very clear where the puck was going. So it kind of made it a very straightforward opportunity to build for.
Yeah, I think I have a question that ties the last two questions together a little bit. So you're in Web3, especially with what you built, you're dealing with some people who criticize. I mean, you're right in the fire since you're on Twitter, and that's kind of where everything's happening. But you're dealing with people who are very passionate. You're dealing with people who have made or lost a lot of money, and the market has gone down, and they're taking losses in a lot of liquid assets. You kind of created this exchange right at the time when things started to go down further, and people try to like blame Blur for killing NFTs. I'm wondering, like, do you think making these markets and having the markets tighten up a little bit has affected NFT prices? Or do you think, like, how do you respond to the criticism that the creation that you have has, ruined NFTs or something like that?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think what has been, I think a lot of like the lessons of finance are pretty non-obvious. And without having that perspective, it's very easy to come to conclusions that seem correct on the surface, but actually if you like understand the details are just incorrect. I think a good precedent here is when, like the stock market, it didn't used to have like all these like crazy derivatives and, financialized products. Like it used to just be like, spot volume only, right? Like just like NFTs were before Blur came around. And when people started introducing things like options and futures and, shorting and, margin and all these things, people were like, oh, you're going to destroy the stock market. Like stocks shouldn't really be traded. Like this is going to ruin everything. And then now that everything's matured and grown, it's like, you can't even imagine the stock market functioning without this, advanced, products. And you would never go and say, oh, these, advanced products that improve the liquidity, they are destroying the stock market. They are making stocks go down, because we just know that is not the case. I think similarly here, what's been kind of somewhat humorous is when we see that sort of criticism, like, oh, Blur is like killing prices. We see it a lot when prices go down, but then when prices go up, we don't hear anything. And then when prices go down, we see it all again. So it's like people only say that when prices go down, and they don't say it when prices go up. I think the reality is, liquidity is liquidity. Liquidity doesn't really change prices. It just means that you can find, the true price of the asset at like the current point in time more efficiently. So if there's real demand for a thing, right? Because when you buy a stock, like when you buy like a share of Apple, you're not buying from someone that's like actually an Apple shareholder, and you just perfectly happen to match with them at that point in time, and you're buying from them. You're buying from a market maker who has like a perfectly hedged position, and they're making money on like a small spread, and that's how the markets work. And then that market maker will eventually either sell to like another market maker, or they're selling to like an organic buyer, maybe like a long-term investor, whatever. But ultimately, when you buy in the traditional market, you're not actually, buying from like a real, quote unquote, real seller. And the market makers, they're not trying to take a long or short position. They're just there to provide liquidity and trying to figure out like what the real price of the asset is, and making a trade at like slightly below the real price, right? So that they can make a small profit. All that is to say, I don't like liquidity doesn't really change the true price of the thing. It just kind of allows for the true price to be found more efficiently. I think ultimately though, it's like, if you look at where the market is today, like the broader financial market, it's like, we're in a pretty bad bear market. There's actually this great investor, Howard Marks. I think he's like the founding partner of Oaktree Capital. It's this like legendary firm. And he always puts out these memos. And he recently put out this memo titled Sea Change, where he basically is just like, for my entire career, we've been investing in these like huge macro tailwinds that have propelled everything forward over the last like five decades. And I think actually now it is different. and we're going to see, you know, the environments change, and the financial environment change. We're going to see like liquidity tighten and all these things. And that's not to say that, you know, crypto is small enough that it can pop regardless of the macro headwinds, right? It's like a small enough industry that there can be volatility regardless of what's happening in the broader world. That's the case with any sort of technology, right? Like even in this like rough macro environment, we have NVIDIA becoming a $1 trillion company. But ultimately we are in this like really tough macro environment, and you're going to see prices correct and prices go down. It's kind of just like a fact of the matter. It's unfortunate that Blur was launched like in this massive sea change. It would have been awesome to launch at the start of the bull market instead. But ultimately, you know, it is what it is. You can't really control the market. The only thing that we can do is, you know, really what I think what's important is, you know, we can't control the market, but do we think NFTs are a thing and are going to stick around? You know, what is the thesis there? And for us, it's like, okay, NFTs, they can be many different things, but we really see them in their like purest, you know, most understandable form as digitally native collectibles. And when you look at where does that end up, right? You just have to look at the next generation of spenders, right? It's like Gen Z. What do they spend their time and money on? They spend all their time and money online. That's very much the case for me. It's like I've definitely spent 99% of my entire, you know, teenage and adult existence just like purely on the internet. And it's very much the case for Gen Z as well. Like, I don't know if you've heard of this concept called an iPad kid. And there's like hilarious TikToks about like iPad kids. It's like going on a date with the iPad kid. And it's like you're at dinner with this iPad kid and he's just like watching his iPad while eating dinner on the day. So
bad like, parenting nowadays.
It's, you know, but it's very common. And yeah, if you look at those kids, it's like, as they grow up, what are they going to spend money on? Are they going to be spending it on like Rolex and fancy cars? Like maybe. I think that's like a reasonable bet, but I think it's just as reasonable to expect that they're going to be spending their money on, you know, digitally native collectibles that show off, you know, status and belonging in community. And so when we think through our thesis for NFTs, it's like, okay, does the macro environment change anything there? Ultimately, it doesn't. So then the only thing that we can do is continue to build infrastructure, you know, that we believe and know from experience, that will ultimately help grow the industry.
So I kind of, you said a lot of things there, and I think I agree with one of them. Maybe unsure of the other one. I don't know if I agree with the third one, but the first one I do agree is I do think we do need more technological development in this space. I think it's crazy to say think that that is not good for the space, that like adding this sort of, I come from a world of market makers. Me and Obi both do, we're both traders for 10 plus years. And I do think that adding things like leverage, adding things like a cleaner experience for market makers to participate in the system, I think those sort of things are useful. Or buy now, pay later. Sorry, I do think it does add a little bit more fragility to the system. There's no doubt when you start adding that sort of ability of buy now, pay later, that like there is going to be more volatility. And you've seen that before, even before Blur was happening, like when NFTFi and BenDAO were starting to see a lot of volume in that space, like there was more fragility to pricing in like volatile environments. What the thing I think, and I also agree with, is that liquidity is not bad. Liquidity is very good for NFTs, and we want to increase as much of the liquidity as possible. What I do think is that when you incentivize the liquidity, it does change the incentives. Like if I was a market maker, even in my old job, and I was being paid to provide liquidity, my incentives are different than just a norm, like just liquidity without those incentives. The idea that the profit that I can make from a trade, I factor in the incentives that I'm being paid. So by nature, it can skew where that profit point lies for me. So like I don't necessarily agree that incentivized liquidity is good for this space. I think liquidity is good for this space. I think more building is good for this space. I think when you add certain features, it can add volatility to the space. But I do think incentivized liquidity can have pretty different impacts. And it really just depends on how much people value that, those incentives. And I agree with you. We're in a bear market. It's been a bear market across a range of different things. So sometimes that can exacerbate some of the moves. But I think liquidity does change stuff. It's not just liquidity.
It's a great perspective. I think probably what's helpful to kind of get more perspective on this is, because TradFi is actually, it's not great to look at TradFi because it is a very different market actually than even like the crypto and NFT market. There's like various regulations and whatnot. It's just like very structurally different. I think the best thing to look at is you look at the crypto exchange market and how it functions there and the relationships exchanges have with market makers. And actually most exchanges have market making agreements where they actually pay the market makers to market make on the exchange. This is something that we did at Namebase. This is like every exchange does this. This is, you know, a source of revenue for the market makers, and they get paid to quote, you know, tight spreads, you know, on the important pairs on the exchange. And there's many different ways in which this agreement can be structured. It can be like a flat fee. It can be a percentage of profits. It can actually just be, you know, based on, you know, hitting performance targets in terms of like the spread where, you know, the market maker is incentivized to quote a tight spread, even if it's like slightly unprofitable, because they'll make it up in terms of that incentive that they have with the exchange. So this is how it works with crypto exchanges. If you look at the way Blur incentives are structured, the incentive is basically saying, you know, if you are a market maker and quoting, you know, a bid and an ask, right? If you list and you bid, then you're receiving, you know, rewards while you're doing that. What that can skew is it can mean that a market maker can potentially quote tighter spreads than they otherwise would because they're getting paid to quote that tighter spread. And if they, you know, are someone sells into their bid or someone takes their listing, they can go and, you know, get out of that trade, and maybe they can take like a slight loss on that. And now that slight loss is something that they wouldn't have done otherwise, because without that incentive, they would have quoted a wider spread. And that is a very similar dynamic to the same way that crypto exchanges will oftentimes pay their own market makers to quote tight spreads that maybe don't necessarily make sense without that payment. But with that payment, the market maker can still be profitable. So ultimately, I think the main change there is really the incentive creates tighter spreads than you otherwise would see.
I would agree with that, but the majority of the liquidities have been on the bid side. So what you've seen is huge bid walls which are more than even the collection size. So the majority of those incentives have been on the bid side, and that's why I think it's been more negative impact for that reason. If it was equal for both sides, I think you could argue that, yeah, that the incentive would be the same. But I think because the bidders have been incentivized, when they then get hit, that's where the majority of the incentives are lying, and that's why people are incentivized to sometimes get out at like flat profit. Now, I agree that like the actual airdrops haven't actually fully happened yet. So people are also, it's on expectations here. So it's slightly strange to work out how that develops over time. But yeah, I do think there's some credibility to it. Basically, what I'm saying. I think
what's really important here though is to get really into the tactical details of how the incentives translate to a price impact that is different than what you would normally see. So, you know, when you say the bid liquidity affects the prices negatively, you know, how does it translate from, you know, increased bid liquidity to, you know, decreased prices? Like what's the A to B there?
So if I'm a bidder, let's say this is an A market, and I know I'm getting an incentive for bidding, right? Let's say I get $5 worth or whatever. I get X amount, and then someone then sells it to me. I can sell it for the price I get hit minus X amount, and whatever that is, I'm in profit. So like I can actually take the price lower, and I can still be in profit because I got incentivized for bidding.
I see. And in that world, so if you get hit, you can sell it for a loss, and you know you think that in expectation you can. That's still profitable for you. In that world, would it not be better for you to list it for either break even or a slight profit if you are a revenue maximizing or value maximizing, you know, bidder? Why are you selling it for a loss in that case? Unless you believe that the price of that asset is something that, you know, you won't recuperate if you, you know, list it at break even or higher. Why would you not maximize your profit there?
You can maximize your profit. I'm just saying that you have that leeway.
I think it's a liquidity thing, right? I guess like you can attempt to maximize your profit, but if there are lots of people attempting the same thing, then the liquidity premium is a lot higher. So people just go for that because it's actually, there's profit maximization in a theoretical world, and then there's profit maximization in a realistic world. And maybe what's happening is the bidders perceive the most realistic outcome for them to maximize profits is actually just to sell at a loss and then make the you know, make the profit on the airdrop rather than listing and waiting for, you know, someone to buy. But
So I guess in that world, what you're saying is the bidder here does not believe, or at least not does not believe that they can,
correct,
you know, probabilistically sell their NFT for higher or break even. And so they'd rather take the liquidity immediately instead of...
Rather just do volume of trades rather than... Yeah.
But I think,
so I guess in that world, if all the bidders are doing that, then that's basically the market saying,
exactly,
hey, I don't actually believe this NFT is worth more than this.
It's actually more of a market thing, I think. Like,
A marketing.
We're in a bear market.
in that world, then now you have the market participants deciding, oh, this item is not actually worth higher. So again, when we kind of get down to the root of it, I don't think that liquidity actually changes the prices. Liquidity just reflects the current prices of the market participants. And when you get into the details, it's hard to kind of find a path where the liquidity is actually, you know, skewing the market prices. It's really just, you know, what you could say is, maybe if these market participants weren't here, no trades would happen, but maybe that person would list at a higher price and then the trade would happen an hour later or a day later. And the trades wouldn't happen at the lower price in the meantime. I think that's a fair point, right? Because like illiquidity, it's like startups, right? Like startups can have valuations that are really sky high. And when there's like a downturn, they don't necessarily get marked down accurately. And then, you know, maybe those startups get marked up in the future. Maybe they don't. Maybe they go out of business, right? The illiquidity can give you a price that is not reflective of the current price in real time. So I think ultimately what you can say is when there is more liquidity, the prices can skew, you know, either up or down, where maybe if there was illiquidity, like 10 minutes, it could seem higher than it was for like, you know, a 10 minute period, 1 day period, et cetera. But ultimately I think that just goes back to, you know, my point, which is liquidity just allows the market to find what the current price is more accurately and more real time. And there's positives and benefits to that, right? Because if prices are going up, it means you're going to find higher prices faster. If prices are going down, it means you're going to find lower prices faster. Liquidity just basically increases the market's efficient walk towards like what the, you know, quote unquote true price is. Not that there ever like is really a true price, but it kind of gets you closer to that than illiquidity. And that's how the incentives effectively change that game.
I do think it'd be interesting to see this in a bull market, because I think something that people forget, and it's easy to blame Blur or blame someone else, is that you have been in an NFT bear market for a long time, and whether this would happen in a liquid way with lots of trading like it is now, whether it would happen without Blur and in an illiquid way and prices moving gradually lower, I think the same thing would have happened. And if we were in a bull market, maybe you'd see the opposite. And
I bet you prices would go up.
I bet your prices would go up. And I think the other criticism people have is they're like, oh, like, you know, everything is just like trading at the floor now. But like, remember, it's just like the floor liquidity has increased a lot compared to where it was before. The mid-tier and rare liquidity has stayed the same as where it was before, right? So it may feel to people that people are now forgetting the rare stuff and just trading the floor, but the liquidity on the rare stuff has never changed. You just have more liquidity at the floor, and that's where most of the trading happens now. So like, there's a lot of factors I think at play, and you know, I'd love to see how this all plays out when you actually have an NFT bull market, which I think will return at some point. But you know, it'll be interesting to see how the comments and criticism changes when we get there.
Yeah, I think just based on experience, what we've seen is typically when things go well, it's just the praise is people using the thing and you know, not really saying anything. And then when things don't go well, you know, people usually only are really vocal when they're upset, right? And so it's actually kind of this like skewed, almost like selection bias, right? Where it's like, or observation bias, where it's like you really only see the feedback when people are upset. But when things go up, they're not. I think the other thing that's really interesting is, you know, even in the bear market, it's like if if liquidity was really changing prices, you would see everything just go down only, versus what you actually see is some collections go up, some collections go down. The collections that go up aren't always the collections that go up. Like, it's like random. And ultimately it's just like, that's just like the market doing its thing, right? Like when there are projects that get, that are building and getting demand, the prices go up. And especially with like buy now, pay later, it makes that a little bit easier as well. Actually like a much, much easier depending on, you know, who the market participants are. But I think the issue is that in a market where, you know, kind of like asset prices across the board, whether you're in TradFi or, you know, tokens or NFTs, I guess if you're in like Pepe or other coins, that wasn't the case. But ultimately, when you see everything going down in general across the board, you know, that's just like a tough environment, and people are going to be, you know, upset about that, understandably.
Yeah, absolutely. As we wrap it up here, we got one final question for you, and then we're going to do some robot loot box spins where we give away NFTs to people when they come on stage. So everyone, go ahead and retweet and comment on the top post on Rec Radio if you want to be included in the robot loot box spins. But Pac-Man, I guess you could tie it in. We always ask our the people we have on the show, can't even think what to call you right now. Why am I having a brain fart there? Yes. But we always ask how not to get wrecked. And I guess you could tie it into, like, we had someone in the comments asked any advice you'd have for a young founder. So maybe like how to not get wrecked as a young founder.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, you know, as a young founder, the thing with being a creator, in this case, like a product creator, right? Like the thing with being a creator is the main risk that you take is on your time. You know, nowadays you're not really risking your capital. That was the case back in the day, maybe, right? You hear people like maxing out their credit cards to like start their startup, et cetera. But now there is like a very strong financial infrastructure layer. So as a founder, you're never really risking your own capital. What you're risking is your time. I think the easiest way to avoid getting wrecked from that regard is just work on things that you actually genuinely want for yourself. That's the easiest thing to ever do. Paul Graham, you know, he founded Y Combinator. He says this all the time. It's just like the easiest thing to do as a founder is just build things that you yourself would want to see. And actually, I remember reading this interview with, or this like article from like Gordon Garner from, you know, the Yuga founder. And he was talking about when they were launching Bored Apes, like at one point they had this like other idea that they thought would like make money and be popular. But then they were just like, you know what, like this is kind of lame. Like we're not excited about this ourselves. And instead, like, wouldn't it be cool if we made this like, you know, like this like ape thing that was kind of like joking about the you know, crypto culture and whatnot. And it just like resonated with them a lot more. And then they ended up launching that. And, you know, then it became this huge thing. So I think ultimately it's just like, if it's something that you vibe with yourself, that's probably the biggest signal. If it's something that you don't vibe with, it's like, it's pretty hard to go and make that work. So just don't do that.
Sorry, man. Yeah. We appreciate you coming on. It was a super interesting combo, a little bit different than what we usually have. It was great to speak to a founder, especially a young founder.